Welcome to the wind tunnel. Some people would pay a lot of money for this experience, being blown to bits. I need forgiveness. First thing that I'm going to do in this 45 minutes is to make you very worried. I've got to ignore us, she says. But I will say stop. If you've been looking in your programme, the theme that I want to take is that in troubled times, then our faith needs to be re-looked at. We need to shift the emphasis that so easily takes the heart of our faith. Now, my hunch is that some of us, including myself, might have thought, well, it was tough times about a year ago. But things seem to have gradually got better. And even swine flu doesn't seem to be the threat that we thought it was going to be. But I'm the child, and I should be careful how I say this, I was about to say I'm the child of Harold Macmillan. But I'm sure some of his inheritors would want to dispute that fact. But I'm one of the generation that Harold Macmillan referred to as the generation that has never had it so good. It's the generation where the expectation was that the great royal red carpet of progress would gradually roll out ahead of me and my ilk. But of course now, 50 or so years on, I look back over my shoulder and that royal red carpet of progress is slowly rolling up behind. We may be the first generation to have that sense that those who come after us will have a far harder experience of life than we ourselves have had. But it's right to question whether we live in troubled times, because our capacity to judge is deeply suspect. Because too easily our eyes adjust to darkness. And we get used to the darkness of human suffering. What's present, our everyday experience, it can so easily saturate the total field of our sight that the present actually becomes invisible to us. We cease to be able to be people who can exercise judgment. Those of you who might have read some of my work will know that I dip into kind of economics and the social sciences. And of course, like many of you, I enjoy dipping into Richard Layard. Richard Layard writes the most profound book on retirement. It's the big clue about when it's possible to be an independent thinker for most of us. And of course, what he does is he explains that the assumption that happiness and money are linked is one of the most fraudulent narratives that dominates our way in which we see the world and experience our lives. And he uses the expression, we habituate to our regular daily experience. And that one of the challenges for us as Christians is to be able to hold off, to see through that habituation, that getting used to. And I say that because we may fail to see just how troubled times have become. So I want to say, we are living in troubled times. I like the word dystopia. Dystopia, not quite the opposite of utopia for any pedants who are sitting in the wind tunnel, but it's close enough to be the opposite of utopia. A dystopian perspective expects predicts that the future will be worse than the present, and it applies to all aspects of life. A dystopian perspective may begin with something quite small, but as we pose questions of it, the answers that come become more and more disturbing and distressing. Each concern branches out into another concern. So each item on the newscast will trigger a quite dismal assemblance of thoughts. With dystopia, underpinning those thoughts is also that sense of a diminished capacity, a diminished human capacity to be able to put things right. So instead of having confidence in technology, particularly in human organisation, instead of having confidence in those things, there's an opposite sense, and we start to focus not on invention and innovation, but on gridlocks and malfunctions. And of course, one of the things that has happened as we move into troubled times is that no longer do we feel we can trust or know who it is to tell us just how it is. Experts used to be the ones we turned to for a measured response. Experts would be the ones who would counter the kind of the fury and the hype that we get from the media. But on more and more issues, whether it be financial crisis or climate crisis, the experts seem to be more apocalyptic than we, the public. I'm a great fan of Zygmunt Bauman. I just love his name. You're bound to be somebody if you dare to be named Zygmunt Bauman. I think he's actually the Emeritus Professor of Sociology at Leeds, which sounds less glamorous than the name. But he, like many modern commentators, or should I say postmodern commentators, talks about the loss of any kind of meta-narrative, any overarching story around which we can feel a sense of solidarity. But he goes further, because he's interested in just how fragmented our world has become, particularly our Western world. So we might have listened to all the great festivals that are going on this bank holiday weekend. And I noted the Greenbelt didn't get a mention. How strange. But each of those festivals almost represent the gathering of a particular tribe. And so Zygmunt Bauman suggests that as our world has fragmented, we have entered into a new expression of tribalism, neo-tribalism. And he says that although we might be slow to acknowledge it, it is a response to fear, disorientation, and insecurity. I bring you a rather dismal assessment that speaks of our inability and our indifference to put things right. There's another book that I'm very fond of. Not just Zygmunt Bauman, which is a good name. Here's a good title for a book from Neil Postman. And it's called Amusing Ourselves to Death. And what Neil Postman suggests, that along with this neo-tribalism, we are also deeply caught up in pleasure-seeking, so much so that the only motivation for action is the anticipation of pleasure, which gives a rather dismal outlook for our involvement in civil society. But I want to say that this is enough misery for anybody. Let's move on, let's change tack into what's the implication for the way in which we express and experience our faith and make our faith manifest, perform our faith. There's no room for disdaining a world that has gone wrong. There's a temptation, and I underline that it is a perversion of our faith to drift towards a disdaining for the struggle that our world experiences. I'm all right, Jack. It won't do. And yet so much of a faulty expression of our faith can coax us into this place, this sort of preoccupation with being able to step aside from the struggle. Tolkien, as well as writing about elves and hobbits, great Christian commentator, actually describes such a mentality as being desertion. Our faith can create a fortress of the imagination, and that fortress is made up of certainty and the collection of right answers. The fact is, whether Christian or not, we remain poor saps, prone to anxiety, prone to fragility, and prone to self-serving tactics, including self-serving faith. I've only recently recognised the significance of Gnosticism. Begins with a G, Gnosticism. And the temptation is to think of Gnosticism as something that belongs to the past, a heresy from centuries gone by. But it's Martin Buber, the great Jewish philosopher, who says that all the time, the biggest risk to people who take their faith seriously, the perpetual enemy to faith in a true God, isn't atheism, but it's actually that claim to know the mind of God, that claim to know that I am safe because I know the mind of God. So Gnosticism isn't just a historical movement. It's a faulty form of religion which produces a huge temptation for us as we move into troubled times. In following Jesus, we commit ourselves to live for others, to have concern for others alongside that struggle to calm our selfish and rather grasping little egos. But Christ died for all, so that those who live might no longer live for themselves, but for the sake of those who died. This calling of Jesus has to shape our performance. And it has to shape our performance, particularly as we move into these troubled times. So what are we to do? First of all, we have to acknowledge the fact that for Christians to talk in terms and with confidence that we might be hope bringers, we might be part of the solution, for the vast majority of people, sounds quite laughable. We're surely the ones who are part of the problem. We are part of that tetchy neo-tribalism that gets in the way. People who think too hard, believe too passionately, take faith too seriously. My concern is that whilst ever we continue to put at the heart of our faith the formulas of our faith, we risk falling into a new expression of Gnosticism. The formulas of our faith are not just unbelievable to the bulk of people, they are actually undigestible, and I'm tempted to say indefensible. So much of our church practice has invested in those faith formulas. I'm not bold enough to say that those faith formulas are wrong. But what I do want to say is that if that is our offer to a worried public, it is no offer at all. It means that we can no longer speak or talk of hope, or to give a formula as to why we can persist in being hopeful when the world becomes more and more troubled. The challenge is how we perform that hope, how we enact that hope. For sure, we cannot give up on hope. But the good news is not just a communication. The good news is also about making things happen. So what are these new priorities for our faith in a dystopian world, a world which isn't just worried but has actually lost confidence in the possibility of being able to rescue itself? We face a very deep conundrum, a very challenging puzzle. The teaching that we derive from the Bible and from our tradition necessitates that we never give up on articulating the persistence and the reality of hope on earth, hope in this world, not just hope in the world to come. But it's become unrealistic to lead with that resource. It's not that that resource has ceased to be a resource. It is that in troubled times it becomes unbelievable and even unpalatable. The other problem, of course, with our faith formularies, if that's what we are to rely on, is that they necessitate control. Our faith formulas, if that's what our primary offer is in troubled times, it implies that some people know and others don't. Some people seem to be spared that sense of being in over their heads. It also starts to articulate a faith which is not so much about resilience, but about exceptionalism. So I have a hypothesis. If only we can put at the heart of our faith practice a greater commitment to reflectiveness, pondering, questioning, then the capacity to enact, to perform hope, increases. However, I also know enough about this world to know that once we start to talk about a reflective rather than a right answer faith, the turbulence that will be created both in our church and by commentators looking in on the church will start to heighten. We have to go through that deeper dip of insecurity as we shift from being a generation that's been fed on right answers, on formulas of faith, moving to a generation that is prepared to think and think deeply and to embrace reflectiveness. Reflectiveness is about prayerfulness. It is about mulling things over. It's both of these things. But it is a tough and disciplined practice, and it's got a distinctive edge to it. Educationalists amongst this gathering will be aware of the work of Donald Shon. 1970 was old Donald writing. And of course there, the issue was, how do we prepare people for the fact that nothing is going to stay the same? It was the beginning of that recognition that in a modern world, tradition, things remaining the same, were no longer going to be part of the story. We needed to be equipped to to deal with uncertainty and continuous change. So Donald Shon starts to pioneer learning systems that all the time what we look for is an increase in our learning. And all the time a question mark about what we think we know. We sit lightly to it. He uses the expression dynamic conservatism because it's not about throwing over all that has been good in the past, but about allowing that to percolate into our understanding of what is happening for the moment. I want to give a very down-to-earth illustration of how we enact hope. And I want to include, as an illustration of enacted hope, something which happens all the time and which so easily we undervalue. And it's the issue of conversation. And I want you to be thinking in terms of conversation, going back to Zygmunt Bauman's comment about a new form of tribalism. And of course, Jesus knew very much about tribalism. In his time in the Holy Land, there were myriad tribes, some more powerful, some more elite than others. I want to suggest that conversation is about the transgressive energy of the Holy Spirit. Conversation and the risk of conversation is about moving out of our comfort zone. It's about moving towards those who are different from us, maybe of a different tribe. The longest recorded conversation that Jesus has with anybody is with the woman at the well. And of course, he arrives at Jacob's well and he's hot and he's tired and he's thirsty. And he has no means of getting access to the water. And along comes a woman from a different tribe, a Samaritan woman. And here we get the first micro action that begins a conversation. There is a reflectiveness about whether somebody from a different tribe and a powerful man in response to a weak and often dismissed woman, whether it's possible to open a conversation. The supposedly powerful Jesus finds himself speaking from a position of his vulnerability, tired, hungry, possibly, certainly thirsty. He steps outside the restrictions of his tribalism. And then, of course, there's friendly banter. So a little bit of risk-taking, friendly banter. But what does friendly banter represent? Friendly banter means a commitment to sustain the conversation. And then Jesus, aware of just how awkward it is for a conversation to be sustained with a woman who's by herself, says to the woman, "Go call your husband. A clue, we can talk some more." And then, of course, the woman replies, "I have no husband." It's interesting when she says, "I have no husband," because what's going on in that conversation is that she is indicating, "I have some confidence in this encounter. I am prepared to take a risk." And of course, Jesus then suddenly understands her situation. This is somebody who's been passed from pillar to post. Five men have married her and divorced her. And the chap who's taken her in now, this time, he isn't prepared to give her the status of a wife. And suddenly Jesus can make sense of the fact that this is someone who's chosen the heat of the midday sun to come and draw water, wanting to put herself apart from others in the village. So excluded, so disparaged by her neighbours, that she'd prefer to suffer the midday heat. And then what we get, and my word, how many times we fail to see this, what we get from Jesus in this conversation is a compassionate aha. Because one of the contributions of conversation is the beginning to see things from the perspective of another person. Aha. Sudden insight into how it is for another person. On my notes, I've been counting the elements that have been part of this conversation. And I'm already into the seventh feature of a conversation. You see, we're so habituated to conversation that we don't realise that conversation is full of tiny little micro actions and actions of courage and discernment. The woman then in this conversation, she recognises that Jesus is, well, a complex character. And maybe she's moving into tricky territory. So in the next stage in this conversation, we get a retreat back into tribalism. And she says, oh, yes, you're quite right, all this talk of living water. Yes, we Samaritans, we worship on the hillside. We're not like you. So moves from heart to head. The conversation's starting to cool. It's getting too dangerous. Should I withdraw? And then the woman stays in her head and she says, you know, I know something about this talk of a Messiah. And this Messiah is going to come and he's going to explain all this kind of stuff to us. And then Jesus says, I am that Messiah. And at that point, what we're having is that Jesus is articulating a new inclusive paradigm. New information. But that new information involves her personal experience and knowledge coming together. Conversation is often one of the most principal tools of our reflectiveness. However, how much in our church life is reflectiveness and conversation given its first priority? Becomes clear that the conversation was as important to Jesus as it was to that woman, because she invites him to stay in the village and he stays for a couple of days. But most interestingly, one of the features of the conversation is that that micro action turns into a macro action as the woman sheds her muteness and she runs to the remainder of her village to speak of what she knows. Micro action moving into a more macro action. Often we don't know what we think until we hear ourselves speak. In conversation, we turn ideas round in our mind. Far from being inaction, conversation is the way in which we change the way in which we view the world and the way in which we embark on changing the world itself. Especially when we risk conversation with those who come from a different life experience to our own, we have to trust in patience and generosity of spirit will be found in the other as we struggle to distill what it is that they are beginning to articulate and share with us. When we work with those who are different, it's their patience and generosity, as we fumble to try and make sense of their perspective, which we rely on. So we have a woman, as a result of a conversation, who begins to gain the courage to speak for herself. We know in our everyday lives that exclusion leads to that inability or reluctance to speak for oneself and to make oneself heard. I sometimes think that we see that, if we wish, most clearly in our church lives, and the limitation of those who are able to speak, either because of a self-imposed reluctance or because of structural reasons why the voices of many and the conversations of many are not encouraged. But Jesus does more than just teach us and demonstrate conversation as a means to reconstrue our world, as the beginning, a micro action that moves towards more macro actions. Jesus also encourages us to take seriously an economy of abundance. Jesus invites us to invest, to take seriously, to practice a self-emptying generosity. It's at the heart of the way in which Jesus lived. It's tempting to see that as a kind of moral challenge or an intellectual challenge. I want to suggest that in fact it is a challenge to our imagination, because the idea of scarcity is deeply embedded in the way we think, deeply embedded at the root of our troubled times. Our whole evolutionary journey has been characterized as being a battle against scarcity. And of course, we have all absorbed a message from our mother's milk that the good things in life are in short supply. So the purpose of our lives, of course, is to gain access to these good things that are in short supply. And we want them for ourselves, for our household, for our tribe. And that pushiness, that determination, gets lauded as being good entrepreneurial stuff in our society. So the skills that we have been coaxed to develop in our world are skills like having a clever strategic mind, an ability to be able to abstract ideas and possibilities from reality. I'm trying not to say the word planning. An eye and a capacity to assess who's friend and who's foe, to resist challenges to our own point of view and our own self-interest, and the assumption that it is appropriate to assume that we live in the context of mistrust and threat. And of course, what else are we to do but invest in me and mine? One of the things that I have grown up with is the idea that Jesus saves me and you and everyone through his death and his resurrection. In troubled times, I think we need also to be confident in the fact that Jesus saves us by showing us how to live. I also want to make the suggestion that we may well be the first generation of Christians that's had that permission to look at the extraordinary way in which Jesus lived. Because for previous generations, we would have become witnesses to ideas that were too disruptive of the status quo, too uncomfortable for the powerful in the land and in the habit of being church. Maybe the way in which Jesus lived offers a portal, a way in to this economy of abundance. And I use the word economy deliberately. A coherent, systematic, predictable relationship between one action and a cascade of other virtuous actions. So what we see with Jesus is that he is someone who in his life knows deeply about the dynamic of power and is able to make choices in relation to it. And you see how he reaches for that great imaginative act that when in entering Jerusalem, when people assume this is the culmination of his ministry and the claiming of power, he has to subvert that use of power. How does he do it? He doesn't argue people out of it. He grasps at the poetry of a donkey. Make sense of that. Reflect on that message, he says to the crowds who come out to cheer him with their palms. We also have in Jesus somebody who is willing to risk being overwhelmed, not always having to be in control. My word, there's a message for the established denominations. I need not spend time in articulating the ways in which Jesus acted that subverted the status quo. But maybe I should spend some time in emphasizing how Jesus consistently spoke about wide fraternal relations. To use an expression from James Allison. We sometimes get puzzled that when we read the gospel in little gobbets, I think it's called the lectionary, every now and then there is the uncomfortable message of how Jesus disses his mother and his brothers. Surely our Saviour can't be so disrespectful. If we could be bothered to read a gospel in its entirety, we would see that this was part of a persistent and consistent message that Jesus wants to say and wants us to see, that in gaining the right to call God Daddy, we also gain wide fraternal relations, and our English language fails us. But that everybody becomes our brother and sister, and that it's that message which starts to become the distinctive message, more than looking after those close to me, my household, my family. We see that Jesus also avoids tit-for-tat behaviour. He'll certainly stand his ground, he'll certainly knows how to be assertive, but he doesn't escalate, he doesn't need to have the last word. It doesn't need to win. Why? Because the winning is long term. It's about seeing things differently. And then, of course, he avoids them and us splitting the categories of clean and unclean. Such an important message in a troubled world with its neo-tribalism. And then we have in Jesus someone who communicates through story and analogy, rather than by rational sociological communication and analysis, or moralizing, or in the formulas of our faith. So we have a clue about how it's possible to communicate ideas and to deepen our thinking without resorting to right answers and to formulas. By taking just one of those features of the way in which Jesus lived his life, and part of the great diversity is that each of us will have a favourite. In fact, I've actually missed out, I've forgotten the one that's my favourite, in that Jesus always seemed to invest in the most unlikely. Our sense of vocation is about identifying that signature feature of the way in which Jesus lived his life and making it our own, allowing it to inform our imagination. Because when we can see alternative ways of performing, what we start to trigger are virtuous processes that counter the vicious processes that are at the heart of dystopia. We live in the churches that are kind of pretty mad on evangelism and evangelization. The time has come, in fact, I believe it is essential in troubled times, that alongside our emphasis on introducing people to the faith and commending the faith, that we also increase our capacity for pastoral care. Pastoral care which enables people to think outside their tribe. Pastoral care which coaches people to think for themselves, to counter that sin of sloth. Because what happens in troubled times is that everybody becomes more anxious. But I want to conclude just by raising anxiety a little bit higher, because a notch higher than anxiety is the category of fear. Jacques Ellul, he suggests that fear dictates two modes of behaviour, violence and rigidity. Pastoral care for the sake of everyone has to help people to find ways of coping with this contagious dynamic of fear. I do not exaggerate it, because we saw it coming to life with the swine flu epidemic. Fear comes so easily. But I want to say more than just fear, because there are some categories of people who in troubled times, history suggests, are more prone to fear than others. And it's the middle classes. It's the secure. It's those of us who live in suburban Streatham. You see, what happens in troubled times is that that investment in the future, that delaying of gratification, that planning, all starts to crumble. Possibly the category of people who know most about living in troubled times are those who have endured poverty. It is the poor who are often better equipped at being able to cope with troubled times. I suspect that in our post-Macmillan era, the era when we have never had it so good, what has happened is that our theology has fractured. Our theology has become naive, and it's become naive because meritocracy has contaminated it, a kind of Daily Mail theology, that the assumption is that proficiency should bring reward. And of course, when proficiency doesn't bring reward, the temptation then is to blame. And of course, those who are most likely to be blamed are those who are least like me, those who are most different. So in contrast to the non-poor, it's the poor who are most likely to have had to cope and come to terms with uncertainty, unfairness, and vulnerability. And that means that there are new lessons to learn. And it's these lessons that I believe need to be at the heart of the pastoral care that we offer, both through our churches and as individual Christians. We need to learn how to be a non-anxious presence in stressful times. We need to become equipped and practiced in systemic thinking in order to resist the temptation to blame others when things go wrong. And as the positive psychologists are now telling me, as did my Sunday school teacher too many years ago, we have to practice counting our blessings, because gratitude is the inoculation against cynicism. And it's not just Sunday school teachers who are now saying it. We need to have the courage to practice these micro actions that counter this inclination towards neo-tribalism and the fragmentation. So talk of social cohesion is not cheap talk, but my word, it needs to be embodied in these micro actions. We need to gain confidence in the viability of this economy of abundance, where the good things in life actually multiply the more we deliver on them. The exact opposite dynamic to that economy of scarcity, where the good things are assumed to be in short supply. And then, of course, we need to draw on the enriching memories of eras past. This is the message from Donald Shawn. Because there are enriching memories from past eras that will affirm our human capacity to correct our own errors. That's jargon for practicing repentance, to correct our own errors. So all of us, and I dare say especially those of us who are non-poor, and I say why I do focus on the non-poor, because I know a little bit about 20th century history. And it was Mussolini and Hitler who found that their most devoted supporters weren't the people who at the moment might be voting BNP, but the worried secure, who decided that their best security was to invest in those who were most powerful and to anticipate what it was that those powerful people wanted to see happen. So I suspect most of us who get to Greenbelt might fall into that category of being the non-poor. And whilst our churches have, for two, maybe three decades, focused on the needs of the poor, in troubled times, I think our imagination needs to be focused as much on the non-poor, like you and me. Thank you. Yes, please. Questions, comments, anybody who can face this wind tunnel and the yellow microphone. This is surely the best venue.
We love it.
Oh, they love it. They've gone senseless, numb with the wind. Any comments or questions? I'd be pleased. Thank you.
You mentioned there the working towards the middle classes. How do you feel that outreaching of faith or the working of faith works differently with the new breed of churches, those religionless churches, than those more traditionally denominational churches?
Thank you. I think one of the things about the new churches is that often they have a strong narrative, that it's being part of something and it's about being able to talk about it and inform one's identity through that involvement. So the established denominations, which I love dearly, when we share the fact that we are committed to an established denomination, a long-standing denomination, somehow it sounds sad. But to talk about the new expressions and emerging reflective churches, I think gives you something to be proud about and something that distinguishes you, but of course risks becoming a new expression of tribalism. So as we know, that the scope to become sectarian is very high, and particularly so, I think, in troubled times, because of it giving a sense of identity and security. Any others? Oh, yes, thank you.
Thank you. I just want to say thank you because I found that a really helpful talk. And I love the fact that you took like intellectual ideas and made them practical for our practice of hope. And I'm just recently become a pastor of a small independent church. And what's inspired me is Henry Nguyen's concept of hospitality in the Wounded Healer. And I felt that what your talk was re-articulating that in more detail, the notion of conversing with people. And taking the time to kind of do that toing and froing.
Thank you.
I just found that really helpful.
Thank you very much. And maybe along with Nguyen's work, to actually say that we are developing, I think, a theology of resilience. And the problem with emerging churches is that they have to be big enough to resist the theology of success. Because I think it's through vulnerability and resilience that we start to have something to offer on the public stage, rather than just for ourselves. I'm seeing nods to say that that's maybe enough and that you need to get something warming. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Anne, and for resisting being blown away by the wind as well. Thank you very much. If you would like...